I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Preliminary data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention shows that our nation's fertility rate has stabilized for the first time in 5 years. It had been falling to the lowest levels on record.
Now that that fertility rate is starting to level off, it has some people wondering, does this mean the American family is starting to bounce back from the recession?
Well, what do you think? Do you think we're finally rebounding from the recession? And how was your family affected? Did you decide to maybe delay having children or getting married because of the tough economic times? You can give us a call and let us know what you're thinking at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kathleen Gerson joins us now. She's a professor of sociology and collegiate professor of arts and science at New York University and the author of The Unfinished Revolution, Coming of Age in a New Era of Gender, Work, and Family. Kathleen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Well, tell us a little bit about what the data is showing about fertility rates in America.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that any one piece of data, you don't want to jump to too many conclusions about it. Taken alone, it's somewhat limited, but if you step back and you put it in perspective, I think it says a variety of things, not all of which fit together very well. It does appear that in the short run, the U.S. is coming back to the kinds of fertility rates that we are used to seeing, although I would also add that that rate is below what we call the replacement rate, which is how many children a woman would have to have to replace the population at its current level, so which would be 2 children per woman. And even the birth rate as it is now, which has bounced back, still not up to that replacement rate yet. Nevertheless, I don't think we're in for some, we don't need to worry somehow that we're, that our population is endangered, that we're not reproducing enough citizens. So I think it's largely good news. The question, of course, is what does it mean? In what ways is it good news? And what other issues does it prompt us to think about?
Well, when we're talking fertility rate, we're talking about the number of babies born basically per year, right?
Right. That, I think, there's a difference between the birth rate and the fertility rate, and I don't want to get the terms mixed up. But the birth rate is how many children are born, whereas the fertility rate within a certain period. The fertility rate really is more likely to refer to how many children a woman of a certain generation can expect to have over her lifetime. So there is a slight difference there. If you think about it, the birth rate can go up and down in a way, whereas over the long run, it's probably the fertility rate that matters more.
So how can you predict how many children a woman will have when she hasn't made that choice yet?
Oh, you can't. And I'm not a demographer myself, but I study a lot of demography. And I can tell you that it's always very dangerous to predict, especially if you're predicting that somehow the trends that are appearing today will continue into the future. That's a very dangerous way to go, which is exactly why I said I think we want to look at today's numbers as an encouraging sign, but not draw too many conclusions. I'll give you a good example of that, which was in the 1950s, when the baby boom was born, and most Americans have heard of that. Some of us are even part of that. I certainly am. If you had simply continued to predict that the birth rate would continue, you would have imagined that we would have gone on to have baby booms into the future. Well, it actually turned out to be a fairly temporary and short-lived phenomenon, exactly because the conditions of people's lives changed, and their decisions about whether or not to have children and when to have children also change. I think it sounds like a very dry term, but the way to think about it is those numbers come from all of those decisions made by all of us, the most momentous decisions we can make in our lives, whether or not to have a child, when to have a child, those are huge decisions to make. And when you aggregate them, it doesn't sound very interesting. But in fact, it represents some very important life choices and opportunities that we enjoy or don't enjoy.
Well, one interesting way to read the data is as proof of a rebound from the recession that we've been in. Mm-hmm. And everyone has, you know, a lot of people, it's hard to find someone who hasn't been touched in some way by mm-hmm. the recession. And one way that they've been affected is by delaying having that child, mm-hmm. broadening their family, maybe getting married. And this is do you see that as a hopeful sign that things are moving, trending in a different direction as far as the recession goes?
Well, I do think that it's probably reasonable to infer that this particular turnaround does reflect a rebounding of the economy. However, I also think you want to be careful not to take that too far. We do know that economic trends do affect people's decisions about the timing of birth, and it probably does suggest that more people are feeling more able to start families that they may have postponed. On the other hand, we also want to keep in mind that in some ways the recession was sort of an extreme version of other major changes which are happening in our society, and those are not going to go away. The rise of women in the workplace, the increasing pressures on families to juggle work with childcare and caretaking, the enormous expense of raising children. So while, yes, I do think it's good news, I don't think we should take that sort of too smugly, because we still need to face all of the challenges of how we help young people and new generations balance work and family, create families, and manage to support them and care for them over an extended period of time. And for that, it's not, yes, it's good that the economy is bouncing back, and it will be even better if it continues to be more stable. But in the long run, we're also going to have to face some more basic questions about creating child-supportive institutions and family-friendly workplaces.
So it's a multi-layered issue. And the fertility rate isn't just a woman's issue, but it does seem to say something about women of childbearing age in our society. Why do you think the rate had gotten mm-hmm. so low?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I would also say, remember, a low is a relative term. The U.S. has never faced the kind of plummeting birth rates that some European countries have faced, such as Italy, Spain, or Russia. On the other hand, we've had a much harder time keeping our birth rate stable compared to other countries, especially countries like the Scandinavian countries. In the U.S., the interesting thing is that to a notable extent, our birth rates have remained more stable than many other countries, but it appears that it's primarily because we're a very welcoming society with a lot of immigration, and that has been able to offset some of the decline in the birth rate among native-born Americans. So
you're saying more immigrants to the country are having more children.
That does always tend to be the short-term effect. And then over time, as people assimilate, the new generations tend to have fewer. So it's been good. I think it's another way to think about the positive benefits of immigration, that we're constantly incorporating new people in our society that keep it going. So that's one thing that does distinguish us. On the other side of the ledger, what you see, the countries, the European countries that have been able to maintain a really stable birth rate just around the replacement rate, which is what most public policy people desire. And here's an irony, are those countries that have made it easier for mothers to work. The countries that have not provided supports for working mothers, ironically, are the ones that have had the most problems keeping their birth rates up.
So, all right, so it's a function of more than the economy, as we're hearing right now. And we're going to take a break and come back and talk further with Kathleen Gerson. She's a sociology professor at New York University. And we want to hear from you on this. How did you decide to delay having children or getting married because of the tough economic times? And what went into your decision making? Is it social policy, as we're hearing about? Is it age? What is it that's affected the size of your family? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
Yeah, it's interesting. Our guest said that this big data all comes down to decisions made by people like you. Call in at 800-642-1234. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now with Kathleen Gerson, professor of sociology at New York University and the author of The Unfinished Revolution, Coming of Age in a New Era of Gender, Work, and Family.
I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Here's the question for you. Did you decide to put off having kids or even getting married because of uncertainty about your personal economy, your job future, what was going to happen? Or did you make a tough decision to go ahead and try to work it out as best you could anyway? Or maybe you're putting off having another kid. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And if the economy wasn't your reason for postponing a family, why do you think there has been a trend of declining birth rates? Why did you decide maybe not to have children? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. And Kathleen, we have a comment here from Tim in Mauston who says, my wife and I are both in our mid-20s and are having our second child soon. I think my generation is just lazy. Broke or not, you can still have kids. It just takes more work. I don't know. Is there something to that?
Well, I think it's important to let people make the decisions that are right for them. So I certainly don't think that Tim's generation is lazy at all. One thing to keep in mind is that the good news is, unlike 100, 200 years ago, people do get to choose whether or not to have children, rather than it being a somewhat involuntary situation, one way or the other. People take that choice very seriously. Children are a lot of work, and it's important to know how much work they will be, in addition to how much of a commitment it will require, both in terms of earning a living and in caring for them before you do it. So I would say bravo for going ahead and having children. And I certainly agree that you shouldn't let anything stop you if that's what you really want to do. Human beings have been able to rear their children quite successfully throughout human history, and we don't necessarily need all the accoutrements that I think contemporary young people may feel is necessary. But it certainly is a responsible decision to make that choice based on the fact that you're ready for it and you want it, rather than it's something you just feel you should do.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for the comment. And next we go to Emily in Minocqua. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Hi. What about your decision to have children?
I think I'm not alone in saying this, that if I were to choose to have children, it would be in an environment where I know they're going to have a secure upbringing. And I'm not one of those who had student loans, but I'm very conscientious about making sure I have a really solid foundation. I know a lot of people who have had children without that foundation, or they've been relying upon their partner and something goes wrong in their marriage. And I just want to make sure I personally have that as secure as I can before I even consider having children. So.
And a lot of people use similar reasoning. Thank you so much for that call, Emily. And that sounds like something a lot of people might say. What do you think, Kathleen?
Absolutely. I think that Emily touches on two really important aspects of this choice today. And the first is the increasing difficulty of establishing job security. the recession certainly brought that to people's minds, if it hadn't before. And even though people may be bouncing back, there's a big difference between having a job and knowing that you've got a secure financial future. And the new economy that we're in is making it harder to establish that sense, not just of having a job, but actually having a trajectory that you can see folk being there in the future. And I think the second thing that Emily alludes to, which is also very important, is knowing that you're in a solid relationship that will be there in the future. And that's also increasingly more difficult to predict. And young people want to be very careful to make sure that they've been able to establish both parts of that equation.
All right. Thank you, Emily. And let's move next to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hey, Charlie.
Oh, hi. Great show. Love talking about something like this, too. I was going to say I'm a physician, and during my training, I had my whole life planned out, and we got married, and 9 months later had our first child. And in a lot of ways, I freaked out initially because I was going, my wife is on a certain plan. I had everything regimented and planned. And, of course, with the new child, I had to change things. I used to get up at 4 in the morning to study.
Whoa.
And then stuff like that to get the time in so that I could still do my job, learn my trade, and still make things happen and try to keep the family happy and do what needed to be done. And although I didn't get to travel, although I didn't get to do things that I had planned, I wouldn't have traded any of it because my son has been just a joy to my life. And I think people a lot of times try to have everything planned, and yet life doesn't fit a set schedule, and we have to get over that. And I've seen with sick children, if you have a healthy child, you're the luckiest person in the world, and they bring so much joy. We need to get over ourselves, be less selfish, and live our lives to help others and help our children, because that's really what it's about.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Charlie. Appreciate that perspective from a physician who had to go a little bit off his charted path there. What would you say to Charlie, Kathleen?
Well, I completely understand and would agree that, I mean, the good news is that once we decide to have a child, whatever the reasoning is, and sometimes it's just closing your eyes and jumping in amid the uncertainty, and sometimes it's feeling more confident and comfortable that you're in a place where it's the right time for you. Whether it happens one way or the other, the good news is that virtually all of us are very happy once that creature is there. And yes, it changes our lives, but we are resilient. People are capable of adjusting and finding, there are always trade-offs, and finding the joy and the trade-offs that more than offset what you might have sacrificed.
All right. Well, Kathleen, we're going to leave it there, but I know you have to go. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with
pleasure.
Us today.
And good luck to everyone out there, whatever you decide to do.
All right. We're talking to Kathleen Gerson. She's a professor of sociology and collegiate professor of arts and science at New York University and the author of The Unfinished Revolution.
Now, as controversy over a proposed iron mine in northern Wisconsin continues, so do disputes over the mining industry's doings and history in northern Michigan. Chuck Kornbach has the first of two stories on mining in Michigan's Upper Peninsula and lessons for us here in the Badger State.
Two open-pit iron ore mines continue to dig deep into the earth near Marquette, Michigan. The Empire Mine has been in operation for a half century and now goes down more than 1,200 feet. From an observation plateau, huge ore-hauling trucks near the bottom of the mine look small and only create a small roar. $260 million of iron ore, worth well into the billions of dollars, have been trucked and shipped out of Empire. So when you ask spokesman Dale Hemela of the mine's owner, the Cliffs Corporation, to describe what he sees when he looks down into the pit, it isn't the trucks or the grays and reds of the exposed rock.
I see a lot of money that's gone from this area and brought money in. You know, what we do here is we take rocks and send it out of here and bring money back.
Hemela feistily rejects the idea that Empire and the nearby Tilden mine, also owned by Cliffs, are giant scars on the land.
Who made that argument? We've been employing people for generations. Give you an example. If you took Tilden, you took Empire, and you took everything that we do here. We impact about 20,000 acres of property here in Marquette County. For that 2% of the property in Marquette County, we've been employing people since the 1960s.
But Cliffs has had recent environmental problems in Marquette County, including unauthorized discharges of waste rock and the triggering of at least one fish consumption advisory. The company says that's not why it plans to close the Empire mine next year, claiming instead that one of its financial partners, a steel company, doesn't want to sink money into improvements. But there are no plans to shut down the 40-year-old Tilden mine, and Cliffs says it will keep running a huge ore processing facility. Inside that hot, dirty, and deafening building, giant machines rumble, rattle, and whistle. Occasionally, you can get close enough to Cliff's spokeswoman, Jennifer Hittner, to hear her. In this case, describing one of the machines called a de-slime thickener.
And these are the thickening tanks. What's happening here is your iron ore particles, which are heavier, sink to the bottom, and the waste material floats out over the top.
But the sound and sight of money being made is not how some people on the Upper Peninsula gauge the mining industry.
Right this way.
Kathleen Heidemann of Save the Wild UP leads a tour in the city of Negaunee, a few miles away from the Empire and Tilden mines, and very close to another mine shut down decades ago. Heidemann points to a building that's crumbling and sinking into ground that's been weakened by underground mining. She also talks about land closed off to the public and houses removed to protect public safety.
This is the sacrifice zone that mining companies talk about, a sacrifice zone. When they talk about mining, there's a certain sacrifice that comes along with mining. It's land or it's air quality or it's water quality. It's literally neighborhoods in this case.
The mining industry says it now does a much better job of reclaiming the land used for mining. But anti-mining activists in northern Michigan say opponents of the proposed GTAC iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin should stay buckled down and prepare to challenge pretty much all of the industry's promises. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in the UP.
And thanks to Chuck for that report.
Next, we're talking to Wisconsin State Senator Glenn Grothman about a bill he's behind to change the way we define barbers in the Badger State.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.